Okay, we are here at the Planning Commission work session on June 5th, 2014.
Okay, so in January of this year, there was a business or organization, however you want to term it, up on 39th Street in the city of Vancouver that was several of the people in the neighborhood had spoke to the Vancouver City Council and then also came to our commission, our county commission, about the activities that were happening there. And Vancouver Police Department had gone in and talked to the people that were running the place. Subsequently, that place shut down and we think reopened somewhere in Hazelden. The community planning staff was asked to draft an ordinance so that we could address these places, but also not infringe or hurt legitimate massage establishments. And that's what we've tried to do here. The initial thought for the ordinance was to have the health department play some role in the inspection of these facilities, but we found after talking with health department officials that that was impractical for a number of different reasons. We looked at other ordinances throughout the state for different jurisdictions that addressed this type of issue and found that the only one that was really applicable to us was for Thurston County, and it was written in the mid-1970s, and it's 25 pages long, so it's not really something that we wanted to model what we're doing after. We also found out that Thurston County isn't really using this ordinance, or using their ordinance at all. They're just it's kind of being bypassed by the folks up there. And it had a number of issues with it. There were morals clauses in it and things like that that we wouldn't have been able to use, and it's probably why they're not using it any longer. So we drafted this. It's nice and short and sweet. Basically what we're trying to do here is before an establishment comes into the county, we want any type of business, regardless of what it is, has to come in and get a certificate of occupancy for the building that they're going to occupy. For these particular types of establishments, what we would like to see are the licenses that are issued by the State Department of Health for all the different terms that masseuses use for their businesses. The State Department issues licenses for massage therapists, massage practitioners, and reflexologists. So we would want to see that before a certificate of occupancy is issued. In discussions, we found that if a business is going to locate in the exact same, a certain type of business is going to locate in a space where that type of business was already established, that they wouldn't need to come in to see the county for a certificate of occupancy, but we think that that's a low enough, doesn't happen often at all. So the vast majority of businesses will have to come in and have a new occupancy established for whatever location that they choose to operate their business. One of the main things we were trying to avoid here was damaging or having too much regulation put on legitimate businesses. And one of the ways that we avoided that is we didn't add a fee. It's a simple, when your business operates or when your business opens, it's simply showing us your paperwork from the state before a certificate of occupancy is issued. Talked to several different establishments, legitimate ones, here in the county. Hand in Stone up on 78th Street by Buffalo Wild Wings. There's a Elements Massage in the Target Center up Hazeldell Avenue. And then there was another one in Salmon Creek that I, for the life of me, cannot remember the name of. But provided them with copies of the ordinance that we drafted this one and asked for their comment, and we received none. So it's my assumption that they didn't have any issue with what we're trying to do. I also talked to a massage school over on 136 just north of Mill Plain. It's in the city, but they're the only school that's licensed in Clark County to provide the instruction needed for the state to issue the licenses. Talked to those folks as well, and they didn't have, or at least I didn't receive any comment from the school either. So what we have here is, on the third page, is a list of exemptions. And what we're trying to do is people that are associated with hospitals, people that are associated with athletic clubs and things like that, are not going to be subject to this ordinance. And the reason that it's coming to the Planning Commission is most of this is in Title V, which wouldn't normally, the Planning Commission wouldn't normally interact with. But Title 40, and this is where we get into the land use part of it, we changed Title 40 for the day spas, massage parlors, and public bathhouses into a review and approval authority. And the review and approval criteria is that Chapter 5.7. So that's why it comes before you for a recommendation. We also talked to NAC, the county's neighborhood association group, and they had no further comment. Didn't see anything that thought needed to be changed, or maybe we could add or anything like that. That's basically what we have here. The county's in a little bit of a more difficult position than a city would be, because cities have the authority to issue business licenses, and with those business licenses, they can attach criteria to those, whereas counties, a certificate of occupancy is pretty much the only way that we would be able to do that before a business opened. And the intent of this is to try to catch these type of things before they open, and to provide law enforcement with additional tools to close them down when they're located.
I have a question about, you said that you asked the health department, and that would be the county health department, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't the state have some responsibility to check for sanitary things in something like this, a massage salon or a hair salon? Or I know that they do in other states for hair salons.
Yeah. And I believe they do that no more often than once a year, if I recall the language correctly.
Right.
The problem is the places that we're trying to prohibit would never go to the state to begin with. The places that we're trying to prohibit wouldn't have these types of state-issued licenses, so the state wouldn't know about it.
Oh, right. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
On the exemptions,
mm-hmm.
That first paragraph one seems a little bit unclear with the timeline, having been in existence 2 years at any time, or 2 years prior to this being enacted. What does that at least 2 years mean? I mean, does that mean if a new LA Fitness opened a new club,
right,
would they have to be in existence 2 years before they could have a masseuse on
no.
staff?
Or no. What would happen is if they had not been open, if they didn't have their doors open 2 years prior to the enaction of this,
mm-hmm.
they would not be exempt from this ordinance. So they would have to provide a copy
Okay.
They would have to provide a copy of their license.
Okay. So they could still do it. It would just be not open.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If that's the intent, I might say just adding one of the adoption of this ordinance just after. Because the way it reads, it sounds like as long as they've been in existence 2 years.
After generally?
They're exempt. I would probably add it after years. I'd add something like from the adoption of this ordinance or something, maybe just some clarifying language, because it's just written kind of broad. I know in existence 2 years, so I read this, I'm thinking that means it's been in existence for 2 years.
Yeah, right.
So 5 years from now, some new athletic club started.
And
2 years after that, they've been in existence 2 years, and they can start
doing
the massages.
Okay.
At least that's how I would read this.
Okay, I can add that.
We'll make the changes.
Clarifying now.
Yeah.
My other question is on number four. Medical clinic, I'm not sure if a chiropractic clinic is a medical clinic or not, but you might want to think about adding chiropractic mm-hmm. clinic to that list.
Sure.
Because you've got chiropractic at the end, mm-hmm. so if they have a written prescription, but I don't know that we want to force, you know, every massage therapist that's working in a chiropractic clinic to always
to have
a chiropractor write it down in writing
yeah.
just to get somebody to go get some massage therapy in the chiropractic clinic.
So say something like massage treatments given in any hospital, medical or chiropractic clinic?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would also express a concern that licensed physical therapists often have massage as part of a treatment,
mm-hmm.
and it's often not directly pursuant to a written prescription.
It's just a referral.
They have their own licensed facilities, and that's.
So you may want to broaden it even further.
So are you saying that a licensed physical therapist would have to have an additional license, or we don't subject them to the provisions?
No, I'm saying they shouldn't have to.
Right, they shouldn't. So a licensed physical therapist covers that section.
Number four is confusing to me. I don't think it's clearly worded. And so you have massage treatments given in these places, or by physical therapists duly licensed who treat patients only upon written prescription of,
mm-hmm.
so a doctor of medicine, a doctor of surgery, a doctor, etc. I think that's more narrow than it should be.
Because you're saying someone can go to a physical therapist without a prescription.
Yeah.
Precisely.
Right, that's cool.
Or if they go there, they could be massaged without a prescription for that.
Okay, so we take out the...
We'll probably find a way to delete...
Massage that one, will you?
Yeah, we'll modify that to take care of the prescription required. You know, many times patients are referred to chiropractic, or they go on their own for
referral. Might be a better word than prescription,
yeah.
because they normally are.
And some go without referral or
I don't get a referral. My chiropractor.
Okay, we'll work on this.
But my chiropractor
we'll
would refer me to his.
Right, but that's not usually right.
No, it isn't.
Yeah. It's like, hey, you want to get a massage?
Go over.
Right,
yeah, you need one.
The problem is
not
written.
Right.
Actually, there are some medical coverages that allow for like 12 massages in a year.
Right.
So you could actually go in without having any kind of referral or anything like
that. You can refer yourself.
Yeah.
Except these are exempt.
These are exempt.
Oh.
Gotcha.
You know.
Well, shouldn't that be exempt? Or?
I don't think that...
Maybe not.
I think they should still comply with the license requirement.
They should have a license.
Right.
Number four is still hard.
But wait, before we slip away from that, it isn't the license part that is this discussion. It's about the verbiage after the license part.
Right, and it's still under exemptions.
But you're creating a finite solution to what is exempted and what isn't. And I believe the discussion is just, if you had stopped it, where you said they were duly licensed, mm-hmm. we wouldn't be having a discussion. Because there's many ways that you could end up in front of a person that's going to give you part of their therapy as a massage. Did you talk to any professional organization.
Yeah, I mentioned that before you came in. We talked to Hand in Stone. We talked to the school over on 136th and Milk Lane. Elements Massage up in the Target Shopping Center on Hazeldale Avenue.
No association.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there is a professional association. There's a lobby.
One of the first things I looked into when I started doing this was to ask if there was a professional association here, and there's not.
There's not.
That's why I went out to each of those massage places individually. Otherwise, I wouldn't have to do that.
So, will you run me through the scenario if a licensed person comes forward and they want to do massage in their home?
If they've been in existence more than 2 years, they're fine. If they haven't,
have a license and they're coming to you, what happens?
So it's like a home business.
Yeah. Are you looking at it from a home business?
Home business. You want to go down their home.
It's in number one. If they haven't been in existence more than 2 years, then they would need to provide their state license before they could get their home occupation business permit.
Okay.
So that's it.
That's the only thing.
And that's the same for every other type, whether you're doing it in your house or not, except for the 2 years part.
And so if they haven't, if they've been in business more than 2 years, then they don't need to contact you at all.
Correct.
That's correct. Yeah, they don't have to. They don't have to. They're not obligated to. The way this is written.
And this would be 2 years from when the ordinance is in
effect. Goes into effect, yes.
Okay. Anything else?
I was thinking about like nice hotels, but then I think we don't have any of those. Like the Heathman or the Hilton are nice, but they're in the city limits, so this wouldn't apply.
Yeah.
So, because you get, you know, that happens. Yep. Why you go to the hotel, you call up the concierge desk and order a massage. And
we don't have anything like that in unincorporated county.
Yeah, so I guess we might have been damned if we should do that.
Who knows? We might have.
Well, and would we want to accept it anyway? I mean, that, I don't know.
No.
I don't know if we want to accept that anyway. Because it's not very burdensome. Requirements to make sure someone applies.
Oh, I think
great.
Yeah, true. Wouldn't want me.
See you in a couple of weeks.
Well, food number two is on this.
Yeah, it isn't burdensome. Mm-hmm.
We can also.
Yeah, we're talking about, you know, five-star approval process.
You got to take these cookies. You can
invite me. I'll find the one hotels.
Yeah, I'll rewrite it.
Right.
Those add to hotels. I got all the comments.
Sure.
Okay. You want some, Ron?
No, thank you.
Okay.
You're good.
Okay.
Everyone.
Good evening.
I don't know if you know Steve Schulte, concurrency manager of Public Works, and then David Jardine, also Public Works.
Concurrency engineer.
And our new staff member.
And our new staff.
Hi, I'm Matt Herman.
Hi, Matt. He's a new planner with community planning, transportation planner. So as you can see, we're here tonight to discuss proposed changes to the concurrency ordinance and the capital facilities plan. The reason why we're changing the concurrency ordinance and the capital facilities plan is that Board of County Commissioners placed that as an item on Public Works work program.
What did they place in your program?
On public, an update to concurrency.
An update.
Yes.
So they want you to review it and update it.
Right.
Revise it.
Update it. So what we're going to cover today is, as we mentioned, the update to the concurrency ordinance and associated capital facilities plan. What we will not discuss will be changes to TIF. Um, As you can see, these are the guiding principles to our update of the concurrency ordinance and the CFP, what we were trying to accomplish. Bottom line is we wanted it to make it simpler for everyone, for applicants as well as staff, more understandable. Are there any questions? Okay. These are the key elements of the concurrency program update or assumptions. As far as point number one, as you all know, the 1.12 growth rate, that's what was adopted by the Board of County Commissioners with this comprehensive plan update. Little bit of history. 2007, the adopted average growth rate was 2.1%. So what's been adopted recently is half of what we assumed in 2007. And then points four and five, just wanted to point that out as additional measures we are retaining in the code to ensure intersections and roadways are fully protected. This what's up on the screen is a hypothetical example of what would occur under the new system. Our current system is based on intersection delay time. We look at a corridor and then look at the average speed over that corridor. The new system is a roadway capacity-based system, where we assume the roadway has a certain capacity and we measure how much of that is used. What the new system we're proposing is simpler compared to our existing delay-based approach. For example, every year we calibrate the model and David or somebody drives around and looks at speeds and that sort of thing. So bottom line is the new system is more predictable and easier to understand. So, and this is just an example of 78th Street east of Highway 99. And that we would assume the capacity and we'd have a traffic study. And under this system, it would be at 50% capacity. The maximum capacity would be 90%. In this situation, this is in concurrency. This is meeting the standard. Are there any questions?
Not yet.
Okay. I'm going to move along then. These are some other elements of our update. In our code, we're going to have a 1 hour peak, but we built in flexibility to allow ourselves to go to a 2 hour peak if we find that works in the future. We are going to evaluate having some kind of status color system to see which roads are close to being at capacity and roads that we should monitor. Once roads are fully built out under our arterial atlas standards, then they're no longer monitored under concurrency. And then finally, our signal section up in Public Works, they're moving towards monitoring intersections and using a computer program and GPS and all that good stuff to do traffic counting and monitor the intersections. Going to move on to the CFP now. It's the capital facilities plan. It's a complementary element to concurrency. GMA requires that we have internal consistency between the CFP and our concurrency ordinance standards. What you see up there is projected 20-year capital funding, available revenue for the CFP. and we're required under GMA to have a fiscally constrained CFP. I'm going to now refer you to the handout, the spreadsheet that you all got received in the in your packet. The columns with the purple. I'm just going to go through the different. I'm just going to run through the different categories real quick. I'll just run through the different categories. Do you all have the spreadsheet?
Yeah,
okay. So number one is committed. That's our traffic improvement, transportation improvement program. Those are the committed projects, and that's not going to change. Number two is what we call the concurrency-driven projects. That is based on the new volume to capacity ratio. The streets where they were over capacity, and we needed to have projects over the next 20 years to address those roads. You will notice under number two category under concurrency-driven projects, there's a category called urban arterial intersections. We wanted to build in that flexibility. If there's a situation where we need to come in and address an intersection improvement. Number three are regional and partnership projects. These are primarily they're projects we have with WashDOT, and that we've had programmed, not funded, and wanted to keep in the capital facilities plan. And then finally, we have the ongoing programs, and those are programs such as bridge repair, the sidewalk program, traffic signal optimization. Those are programs we've had all along in our CFPs.
In the section two, where the comments are like 1.7 capacity, what's that capacity? What does that comment mean?
The 1.7 capacity.
Yeah.
That means that it's so the capacity is one and it's 70%. It's way over capacity for the northbound travel northbound lanes.
So its current status is.
Okay. No, that's over the next projected over the next 20 years.
Okay. Thank you.
So it's we looked out 20 years. We saw this northbound lane is going to be a big problem.
And these regional partnerships that you're talking about with WashDOT,
yes.
Are there? This is over the next 20 years too.
Yes, this is yes. Yes.
Okay.
So the CFP that we adopted in 2007, you can see the amount in that CFP, top number is with inflation. Underneath that is that amount in 2014 dollars. What it's going to take, that middle number is what it's going to take in 2014 dollars to complete that CFP that we adopted in 2007. And then the bottom numbers, our funding group in Public Works, this is the projected revenue based on identified sources. I want to go back to that growth rate number again. I think that's really key, is that, again, what the board adopted is half of the growth rate that was adopted in 2007. So accordingly, we also have to shrink our CFP. And the cost and the revenue are consistent with the new CFP, consistent with the new concurrency standards. Any questions?
So we made it match.
Yes.
Are there going to have to be more changes given the jobs projections the board selected, they're pretty aggressive with jobs. So is that going to potentially bump CFP up?
Well, let me answer it this way. We're updating the CFP and because we have to with concurrency.
Right.
We're going through this comp plan adoption process, and it's possible that we'll have to tweak the CFP to be compatible with the new comp plan. And jobs and transportation, it's difficult to predict. It could be that it might be we have more jobs here, fewer people commuting over the river, it might be better.
And what I would add, Laura is correct, it will also depend on the land use choices that we made on the three alternatives that will come out of the allocation of the new growth and jobs, and how does that play out in the landscape. If it doesn't require significant changes in the land use, the CFP may still be sufficient to meet the growth targets and what we are planning for 20 years. If the land use changes significantly with that, adding land to the UGB or changing commercial or changing industrial to commercial, that we know is going to add more capacity to the roadway, it may require us to reassess the CFP again. But all that is going to depend on the land use and the choices we make going forward. Does that answer your question?
I think so. So let me ask the question a different way. Maybe it's a little more clear. If, because of the job projection that they selected, when we do the comp plan review, we have to add in an additional large chunk of industrial and commercial land to meet that projection, will that addition of more land in the UGA for jobs force us to update this again higher to be able to meet? I mean, if we're going to put in 200 more acres of industrial in Ridgeville, is that going to, that will cause a review then of the CFP, because the CFP has to match what the comp plan has in terms of, if that's all built out and everything comes to fruition that they're planning, or is there hoping or whatever with the high job number. Does that make that?
Yeah, and my answer and Laurie's answer will be the same. It depends on the land use choices we made. If we indeed determine that there is a need to add additional land, and then it happens to be in Ridgefield, the Ridgefield, not the county, the Ridgefield have to go through their own process and submit a CFP that supports that expansion.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. We're not anticipating more than $540 million in revenue regardless.
That's true, and as Laura indicated, looking at the decisions that the board have made and looking at the current land use designation and zoning, this is all based on the current and anticipating no significant change in land use, that we will peel off some projects we may no longer need, and therefore reducing the cost.
So I think that's kind of the answer, John, is there's your cap. The projects might change. The name on the line might change. But there's the cap. Unless you come up with more revenue.
Yeah, I just might add that the $510 million to $540 million, that was done by our capital programming specialists.
Yes.
Lots of outreach to grant agencies and others that are in the funding business, and that's what they're telling us. That's what we can expect in the next 20 years with respect to road fund grants and all those funding sources.
State, federal funding sources.
The cost of roads, not much.
So we have a requirement to create some form of level of service, right?
That's, or to have one, yes.
That's a state requirement part of DMA, if I understand that correctly.
That is correct.
Yes.
Okay, but we get to set the level of service, is that correct?
Yes.
All right, so our level of service also drives the choices of what projects we go after, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so we have the ability to change the level of services as to decide where we're satisfied with the functionality or where we would want to change that functionality, which could potentially free up capital for other projects.
Well, the board, yes, they set that level of service.
They do, but they do that based on our historical precedent and recommendations from you, right?
Hypothetically, the board has great discretion in level of service, they said. If they wanted to go into an area where they wanted to promote development, they could set very loose standards.
Yes.
If they wanted to restrict development, they could set high standards. That's all local determination.
Right.
They historically haven't chose to do that. Be very consistent across the entire unincorporated county.
Yeah. And so our level of services, if I recall correctly, have been such as the speed that it takes to get through traffic lights, the corridor speed in which from one light to another you're able to travel
at
peak times.
That's the current standard.
If we said it's okay to wait through the light three times or four times and 7 miles an hour at peak time is okay, then we would basically saying that corridor is okay. We don't need to spend this millions and millions of dollars on it. Let's go put the money someplace else. But if we just keep the one level of service as applied to all county roads outside of any municipal jurisdiction, then everybody's treated the same without regard to where they are in the county. Right?
Yes.
That is correct.
Okay.
Previous okay. was 1 to 2 hour peak hour. I'm flipping through here. I don't see it mentioned in this. These code sections in here. Is it somewhere else?
What was the one? We didn't say exactly 1 to 2 hour peak hour.
Well, you were talking about it in the. You said it's generally one, but you want some flexibility for two. And
we had written some.
Yeah. And I was looking for the code that discussed that.
Actually, it's not necessarily spoke.
It's not
specifically 1 or 2 hour. It is a peak period.
That's right.
The period is the 1 or the 2 hours.
Right.
If you go to section G, about five pages back, go to the second page of G, and go down to the new D, the dog.
G, yeah, that's what I was looking at.
Which is line 22.
The low standards identified in this subsection shall be applied during peak period traffic counts.
As
defined by the Clark County Review Authority. So that's you.
That's me.
Yep.
You.
That's him.
Well, that's right. I heard you retired.
I am retired.
Oh, yeah, and now you're.
He's passing
you have
the
a different,
torch.
Yeah.
All right. I'm passing the baton. Okay.
Yes.
But you aren't retired. You're retired from that.
So do you have those written down somewhere, or what does that mean as defined by the Review Authority? Is there a table or a guideline, or is that just on a case-by-case basis?
What's behind that right now? Everything you're going to see today was based on the old one-hour peak hour, 60-minute peak hour. All the analysis, everything we've done, we're leaving flexibility. Our county commissioners requested the flexibility at a later date to possibly start looking at a two-hour peak. So that's why we crossed out the word hour and put in period. Everything you're going to see, all the calculations, the funding, the levels of service, all based on the old one-hour concept.
Okay, so then where it says as defined, that's something you haven't really defined yet?
Well,
in a formal way, or?
Yeah, when we do analysis on the peak period, typically what happens is the 1 hour is a national standard.
Right.
Where you get into the two-hour peak is like in Southern California when you're on the freeway for over a two-hour period of time. the peak comes up and it stays there, plateaus, and then goes down at maybe 3.5 or 4 hours. So, right. Well,
so but so like I know Metro, they went from 1 to 2 hours because they wanted to lower the standard of
that's
service
exactly
without
what
actually saying that we're lowering the standard. Of
service. You've hit the nail on the head. Yes. That's exactly what that 2 hour does. So, in the 1 hour, it comes up sharp and then drops off. What happens in that 2 hour is now you spread the traffic out and it flattens the peak and lowers the standard.
Effectively. So yes. I guess I'm just wondering how this is going to actually work in practice. Is it going to be on a case-by-case basis?
No.
Are you going to at some point at the direction of the commissioners come up with a review document that will be the official definition that you're going to somehow adopt, or how is that going to happen?
We wanted to address the board in having the availability to go to 2 hour peak period because that's what they expressed interest in.
Well, it makes some sense. And if you've got budget issues, and that's one way to
meet
the standard.
what happens currently, and we actually don't have any roadways in the county that are even near having a 2 hour peak. That the 2 hour peak would be effective. You'd still notice a really sharp rise and then dissipation in 15 minutes. So it would never benefit us to go to a 2 hour window.
Well, unless you just wanted to lower the standard and not have to
declare
a moratorium or come up with.
When we looked at, we consulted with RTC on the projected traffic volumes over the next 20 years. As David was saying, we're very much still a peak hour. It's that peak hour. It's not a situation like such as in Portland, where you still have a lot of traffic on either end of that 5 o'clock hour.
And so what the city of Portland does, and they're the only ones that actually have or use that 2 hour window, and what happens there is they test against the 1 hour peak. If you fail in that 1 hour peak, then they go to the 2 hour peak and test you there, and you pass there typically. And in their particular case, in a downtown situation where you may fail the peak 1 hour drastically, they can help reduce the standard and get you out of mitigation by expanding that to the 2 hour.
Right, and I guess I'm just trying to get my head around how's that process going to work, given the language. Given the language here, I mean, it sounds like you're going to do some kind of definition.
Right.
What I'm not clear is it going to be in writing? And is it going to be once you do it, it's going to apply to everybody? Or is it going to be like kind of Ron says, well, maybe we can do it different for this corridor because this corridor has got more traffic, and so we're going to go let this corridor go to 2 hours now? Well, how is that in practice? How is that going to work given, you know, if we just adopted this word for word, then it's as defined by the review authority? How are you going to?
I think we'd see it coming too. If we got to the point where we needed to say, well, the Salmon Creek corridor is worse than it ever was, and we still want to allow development to occur, we need to go to a 2 hour window. I think we'd see it coming. I understand what you're saying. It's the text is really vague, and we tried to keep it that way so that we could have that flexibility. We'll work together.
In other words, as defined by when we decide to define it, and if necessary.
I just want to understand what's going on. Okay.
So it's not defined
at all.
Sure,
applicants are that thrilled by flexibility.
Well, it
depends on which way it cuts.
Wow, yes, exactly.
and it is defined. If you go to Section N, a few pages back. Section N, there is a complementary document. It's called the Concurrency Administrative Manual.
That's right.
And that is where the specific details, like a single peak hour concept,
are defined. Okay, there's the answer. Thank you, Steve.
So,
yeah, I forgot about that, and I wrote it.
But the complexity of converting to 2 hours, we could change the standard in a matter of minutes. But the challenge is we have these computer models with all these past reservations with four developers with specific trips at this intersection, specific trips at that intersection. We'd have to go and convert all of those from a 2-hour 60-minute period, or from a 1-hour 60-minute period to a 2-hour 60-minute period. All of those thousands of placeholder trips reserved for future developments. That we'd have to go back to that McDonald's out there and say, okay, you reserve 60 trips an hour. If we looked, if we averaged over a 2-hour, would that go down to 55 or 50? Imagine doing that for all those reserved trips. It's a huge job.
And well, and there's more to that story. So if you have to go back and look at each one of those developments may have had mitigations that were required. Do you release some of the mitigation?
Yeah.
I don't think so. But it becomes a big mess when you start doing that kind of stuff. But we wanted to keep that option open,
okay,
in case we ever got
so
there.
So if I understand this right, you've got an administrative manual,
yes,
in the section N that you publish and regularly update.
Annual.
So if you wanted to go to a 2-hour, you would publish an amendment to that manual. And then that 2-hour could be for the whole county, or it could just be for certain corridors,
sure,
depending,
yep,
on whatever analysis you do at the time.
That's correct.
So if I'm a member of public and I want to know, is it a 1-hour or 2-hour, I go to the manual. And whatever is in the current manual is going to be the standard. And if it's going to change, you're going to update.
Yeah.
I just want to get my head around the procedural process for changing.
Sure.
It sounds like that's it.
Okay. So, playing off of what Steve is saying, then I guess if we go back to line 22, that's the new D on page 6, where it says, as defined by Clark County Review Authority, you could include just the brief statement and published in your administrative
manual.
Right.
Which,
okay,
would then have given the connectivity, I think, of what Steve was saying.
Yeah,
that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah, that would make a lot of sense.
So as defined
then,
by...
Then I know how it, you know, where it comes from.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Published. So
published.
Okay.
I think it also makes it better for the public thinking it's, you know, it's in a published manual as opposed to it's just, you know, whatever you
need. Yeah, because this sounds a little shady that you guys can just go ahead and change it when you want to.
Okay. Well, especially if you can't find the definition anywhere.
Well, and now that we're not peak hour, but we're peak period,
okay, well,
that isn't even say that it's necessarily 1 or 2 hours. It's just...
And,
period of time.
And that's what we were going for with the peak period. And then,
yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You might get that part. In C1 and C2, which is still talking about
hours.
Yeah.
Peak
hours.
Oh, peak period.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anywhere that has an hour should be period.
Okay.
This one's a peak traffic session. Peak hour.
Peak period.
Peak period.
Okay. That's good. Thank you. I'm just going to move on unless there are any more questions or comments. This is good. So this map is this shows the 2007 our existing adopted capital facilities plan. The red shows where we have projects needed. And then this is what we're proposing for the capital facilities plan. And you'll see with the red that we have a lot fewer. The point of this slide is to show there are fewer projects compared to the 2007 CFP.
And it's real hard to differentiate the colors, but there are three or four different colors up there to mean different things. It's hard for me to tell.
I think it's those different categories. The concurrency projects, like 72nd Avenue that goes way up to Battleground, that's a concurrency project.
Okay, so what do you want to convey with this information? I mean, who's your audience for this?
When we initially put this map together, it was for the board. That was something one of the commissioners wanted. And I think what he wanted to visually show is that you have fewer projects with the new CFP.
So if I'm doing this for lay people, what I would do is I'd show the first slide that's basically funded and going to happen concurrency and put those on there. And then I'd do another slide that would layer over then the next ones that are proposed and probable within the guidelines for whatever reason that we're funding those. And then if you need a third slide that layers in the last ones, and that adds up to your $540 million, you can kind of show them the sequence.
Okay.
If it's for us, you give us two colored slides in a packet, and we'll figure it out.
Okay.
It's difficult to see, like Steve was saying, under this circumstance. So if you want the people in the audience or general public to look at this, I would try and make it easier for them by differentiating the colors individually and then just layering them on top of the other.
Okay. I'll do that. Okay. Finally, see next steps. We made a presentation to DEEB on May 1st, and they unanimously voted to support our update. We just met with them today to touch base, and there's an email in your packet. The email is, it says Lori Lebowski at the top, and it's from Mike Odrin. At the bottom is Chris Bremer. So, just to back up, as I mentioned, we presented to DEEB on May 1st. We asked for their comments by May 16th. We received this email today from Chris Bremer. He's a developers consultant with Kittleson. And at the bottom of that page is his proposal as far as just an idea for the concurrency ordinance. We discussed it at DEEB today, and they suggested that you all see the email. They didn't make any formal recommendation, just that you all have a copy of the email. And I think what he was attempting to do was to build in some way to, if an applicant comes in and they feel that they need more flexibility, that they can have the ability to have a study or kind of a more tailored approach to concurrency for their situation.
Is their project so special?
Well, I think, David, you made a really good point earlier today about that can be a double-edged sword, that they could have a special study, but it might be work against them.
It's possible. With this new method of looking at concurrency, we've got in the ordinance that you've been given that we're looking to modify, we've got a table in there that says if you're an urban arterial, you got this much capacity if you're built out. Well, so in a lot of areas in the county, what we have are rural natured roads in an urban area. So they've got an urban classification on them, but they're narrow lanes, no shoulders, ditches that drop off into China. Mm-hmm. All that plays into the capacity. So if a developer is saying, well, you know, we're only putting X number of cars on the road, but it's sending us over this 0.9 volume to capacity ratio that's going to trigger a bunch of mitigation, we want to do a special study. Well, there's special study on that segment of roadway, say from the WSU entrance on Salmon Creek Avenue up to 50th Avenue. Very windy, narrow roads, no shoulders, big ditches. When they run that analysis and look at the actual volumes on the roadway, that volume to capacity ratio could work against them in that there's much more traffic on that roadway than what it can actually handle. So that 0.9 that we say that they're at, just running a rough calculation, is now, after they do their specific analysis over that segment,
now says it's like a 0.98. So they could end up with some bigger mitigations potentially. So it could work against them that way, but I think the bottom line of the email here is that Chris Bremer, he's a traffic engineer for Kittleson. What he was trying to do is he was trying to build in some opportunity for, again, some flexibility for an applicant that wants to kind of move in the direction of we may need to do some big mitigations out here, our V over C ratio when we run the calculation. It has it at 0.9, but we believe that the roadway isn't actually operating at that level, and we want to prove that to you. And that's what this language is talking about. They want to have the ability to provide the additional information and have staff and the Public Works Director look at this information and make a site-specific determination whether or not it is actually at a 0.9 and mitigation is required, or there's maybe additional capacity that is actually left on the roadway today. I think it's a great suggestion, but I think we've already got some language in our code that allows them to do that today. And basically what that is where a developer's consultant in the preliminary stages of their analysis can submit to staff kind of their preliminary findings that says, gosh, we're not sending any trips to this roadway. Can we reduce the scope of our traffic study by not adding this link in here or this segment of roadway? If staff can validate it, staff can make a recommendation to senior management as well as the Public Works Director, and then modify the scope based on their preliminary evaluation. Something that we can add to the documents and the ultimate findings of the staff report that that support that reduction in scope of the traffic study. We've already got that language in our code.
Isn't this two separate types of issues, though? I think one of them, what I'm reading here, is he's challenging the veracity of your model and saying that he wants to provide data that says your volume to capacity ratio is not correct. And if that's the case, it's not site specific the way I'm reading this. It's the corridor.
Now what do you see? If you go to section G, the table in section G, the table in the lower half. You can see the right hand column, there's some numbers, 2000, 1800, 1800.
900.
And in the text above, there's some numbers. So those are the capacities we're saying each type of road has, vehicles per hour. What Chris is suggesting, that there ought to be an open door for if someone disagrees with this for their unique situation, they should be able to come in, do an independent study, and staff will consider treating them differently.
Yep.
So that's the policy question. Should we have numbers that everyone conforms with, or should we open the door for kind of what I call custom calculations?
So we're saying that any collector could be up for a challenge on whether this is the right number for it or not. Any arterial would be up for a challenge on whether this is the right number for it or not.
That's correct.
That's how you interpret it.
Right.
Email. Yes.
And we have, like in the traffic impact fee code, there's an independent fee calculation option. If a developer thinks their development doesn't fit a TIF category well, they can do a special study. And my experience through a lot of years is that usually those special studies turn out in the developer favor. Can't remember a lot that have not turned out in the developer's favor. So, and it takes a lot of staff time. If it's not going well, they'll get attorneys involved. And again, I guess the policy call for the Planning Commission, and it's a good one, should we open stuff like this up for specialized calculations or keep the door closed? Have more of a categorical approach.
But, and what we were trying to accomplish with the new standard was to have a simpler approach. And I think, as was mentioned, there's flexibility built in as far as the capacities, and it's specified the capacities for different types of roadway designs.
It's a policy call because, as Steve is saying, we have had, even whether it's through the annual review or to some development application, you know, dueling town staff and engineers on the other side disagree, you know, who is right and who is wrong. So
it seems potentially very messy to have you having to validate their numbers each and every time a site-specific comes in and wants to challenge this rather than do it. I mean, it seems like it'd be better to handle it even in the context of just agreeing to lower a corridor's level of service rather than trying to do it site-specific.
Usually when there is special studies, there is some negotiations and there's some degree of compromise. That's the real world we work in.
That's all I have. We got a hearing July 17th. We just wanted to build in time for any changes. But otherwise, we'll see you July 17th.
Okay, so this one's not June 19th, the massage parlor, July.
That's the only thing we have on the 19th.
Yeah.
So come prepared.
Memorize the ordinance.
Yes.
It's a pretty short ordinance.
It is.
Get a massage before you come.
Yeah. Or after.
What's my slide?
It is.
Yes.
Maybe.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm following. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Planning Commission members, there are three documents in your packet. One is the PowerPoint, and I'm going to go through that with you. And the second is the board principles and values, what I may call guidelines that we have to use in the 2016 plan update. The third document is the 2016 planning assumptions, and I'm going to go through that also, cover that in my PowerPoint presentation. I will not be covering the board principles and values in my presentation. We just provided you this for you to review. The two documents, I must say, the board will have to affirm. They've already seen this at their work sessions, the principles and values and the planning assumptions. We are going to be having a work session with the board on June 18th to present to them the growth allocation that we, the county, and the local cities have agreed to. And then on the 24th, bearing no major hiccups, we will then go to the board on the 24th of this month to present to them in a public hearing the growth allocations for them to approve, take testimony, and approve them if they can, and also take testimony on the planning assumptions as well as on the principles and values, and give the public the opportunity to weigh in. With that, what I will do in my PowerPoint presentation is just quickly give you an update as to where we are, and then this is our format of bringing you up to speed and taking questions that you may have. You may have seen this before, and I apologize, it's much better in your the one in your packet. Good staff here, Mary Lee, have been saying the more we use colors, it becomes very problematic to preserve, and I agree, but I apologize for the how it's shown on the slide here. This is a condensed timeline, if you will, to make it much, much easier for the public and the board to follow through. We have a 3 or 4 page scope of work that we've prepared, but this is a condensed version of our timeline. You can see quickly when we started the project. This is our kickoff date. It was July 2013. From July to December, we accomplished what we were calling pre-planning. I'll move my and engage the board in discussion about the GMA overview. We also had a work session with them on the vacant buildable lands model that we use, which is our tool for land inventory. We presented them with a preliminary scope of work and timeline. We also presented to them the public participation program for the F4th, which they later approved, and I have some of the dates in here. We are now into this big column in the center. We've done public review and comment. We've prepared a checklist that is required. The purpose of that checklist is to look at all the recent amendments to the growth management statute and make sure that as we do our update, that our update is consistent with all the amendments made since 1990. We've also gone to the board, presented them with the Office of Financial Management population forecast that was published in 2012. For the counties planning under the GMA to use in their planning update. We have come to the board planning commission with the streamlining that we are doing on our plan document policies. You've seen that. We also have completed review of the planning assumptions. We had a second work session with the board on our buildable lands model, and I believe Bob Poole came here and presented you with that model too. We have made the output of those models to our local cities to review and approve and tell us what are the pluses and minuses relating to that model. We are internally working on what we are calling technical report that the PC will see sometime in the coming months. So that's any of the things that you see checked off, we have completed. These are things that are currently in progress. We will be moving very shortly to phase two of the process, and that is the growth allocation. If approved, we will ask the cities. You hear me often say that what we are doing is like a puzzle. The cities will tell us what type of land use options based on their location, and we will put all that puzzle together and see what the picture looks like. With that, we'll take that out to the public and do what we call scoping, which I will get into, to tell us what level of CEPA do we have to do. As I mentioned, these are the decisions that the board have made to date. They've made a decision also put at a work session at a hearing. I'm on slide two, where they affirmed or directed us to on the population that we have to use for the plan update. This is the mid-range of the OFM forecast. It's an annual growth rate of 1.1. As Laurie mentioned earlier, and you will see this in my other presentation or slide, the board in 2007 chose a population growth rate of 2.2 in the first 6 years of the plan, and 2% in the remainder of the plan, which averaged out to be 2.1. Since then, we have not been growing fast as was projected by OFM, and there are a variety of demographic reasons for that. The board also, having gone through a series of work sessions on April 1st, at their public hearing, taking public comment, and after that, they directed staff to plan for a job aggressive planning for the next 20 years. This is the fourth scenario that came out of the job projection from ESD, Scott Bailey's work, and who we have relied on his projection since 1994. So this is the number that of new jobs that we are going to be planning for as part of this update. And this equates to about a ratio of 1 to 1. You know, that's how to look at it. This is not 1 to 10. The board also have had a series of work sessions, two total, on planning assumptions and on their principles and values. And they affirmed on May 14th to make some changes to the planning assumptions, and I will get into that. This is on my next slide. So this table illustrates the planning assumptions. On the first column are the planning assumptions. These following the second, the third, and fourth, and the last column are the years in which we have used those assumptions in each of the plans that have been we've gone through. In 94, in 2004, 2007, and now 2016 going forward. This column just represents the OFM range that is projected for the county, and it is within this range that the County Board of Commissioners under GMA requires them to pick a number. In the past, they've picked a number close to or higher than the medium. This is the first time that the county have picked a number still within the range forecasted by OFM. So the number that they picked is 562,207, and that falls between the low and the high range. What that represents in terms of the new population or new growth we're anticipating in the next 20 years is about 136,000. And it is this number, it is this number that we have to do the urban and rural split. You can see what was used in 1994, very close to 80-20. Since then, the board, as a policy call, have kept that ratio, or moved that ratio to 90-10. In other words, 90% of the new growth we are planning for should be in the urban area and 10% in the rural area. That's how you see this. This, the annual assumed growth, population growth rate, you can see what they've been over the years that we have done this update. Now, given some changes in the demography, the annual growth rate is 1.1. The board have kept the housing ratio split. After the 1994 plan, it was changed to 75-25 in terms of the split between multi-family and single-family. In 1990, the ratio was too high. None of the cities were meeting that 60-40, so it was shifted with some extensive discussion with local cities to narrow it down to what is more reasonably occurring on the ground. I can say that the city of Vancouver is very close to the 75, or not even exceeding the 75-25, but that's because historically, majority of the multi-family that have occurred in the county have occurred in the city. There are some cities that are coming closer. Washougal, they have had some experience with multi-family development in Washougal. Camas is now cashing up. The county did not prescribe to any of the smaller cities how to meet this 75-25 split. It's up to them. It could occur through townhouses, you know, condominium, duplexes, triplex, you name it. So it's up to them on how they meet this ratio. The persons per household numbers, these are typically based on census. This doesn't come out of the thin air. You can see what it has been over the years. After the 2004-2007, we used the 2000 census, and this average. There are some areas where the persons per household is higher than what you're seeing, but this is average countywide. Given the recession and other factors, we're seeing kids moving home, we're seeing, you know, doubling up occurring. The persons per household number have jumped to 2.66, so this is average. There are some areas where this is, you know, you see three, you see four. But this is the average, and this came off of the 2010 census. So the board confirmed us using 2.66 persons per household. Here's the 91,200 new jobs that they confirmed. And they also agreed to move away from the way we measure jobs to population or jobs to household. So we are moving to from jobs to population ratio to jobs per household. That's a better measure. The reason we recommended that is, you know, that majority of the new growth, some of them are caught through natural birth, some of them are caught through people moving into Clark County. So when you do a ratio of 1-to-1, you're counting newborns that wouldn't find job, and you, including retirees. So we move it to what is more reasonable measure and can be you know, supported. Now I'm going to just per household. In any given household, you may have husband and wife, or husband and teenagers. Maybe one or two are working, or all are working, but on average, 1-to-1 is what the board recommended. Another area that there have been interest is the infrastructure deduction. This only applies to residential. This is how much that is eaten up by roads, parks, other utility right-of-ways, and stormwater is included in here. I know I've been to DEEB a couple of times, and they have been asking that this number go up because of the new stormwater regulations. What I've said to them is that, you know, I have what this type of information is often what I refer to evidence-based type of data. There have been some studies done locally, both from our environmental services staff, our GIS staff, and some of the local cities that have shown that the 27.7% for residential infrastructure is really high. There are some areas where we know that percolates much better than others. So there will be 30% infrastructure deduction, there will be 40%. But this is an average when you take when you look at some areas that, you know, the amount of land, if it percolates very well, there will be very little. You know, so on average, this is what we're saying needs to be the case. This is for residential. We also have infrastructure deduction for commercial and industrial, and it's 25%. You will see that as I go on. The board also asks that we retain these values that we use in determining what is vacant and what is vacant or underutilized under the commercial and industrial model. There is interest to revisit this because we know, given inflation and new assessment and new information, the value cannot remain the same over time. So our GIS and assessors are looking at this, but for the time being, my understanding is that it probably will take about a year or more before they really get a handle of what is happening. We know also that assessment lags, you know, so to catch up is going to take us some time to remedy this. But overall, the model has been very predictable in looking back 20 years. We've had experience with the model for 20 years. So they agreed, and Bob Poole is still looking, but Bob Poole has presented some preliminary evidence that says this is still reliable, or what you may say, good numbers to use in the interim.
Okay. Really hard to believe. Those numbers are so low to say that 13,000. I mean, what is that?
Well, you know, you may find, you may be hard to find, but there are some areas where you may find, you know, a barn sitting on 2 acres, a shack, you know, is that barn, old barn, worth $13,000? Maybe, maybe not. You may find a mobile home, you know, sitting on.
All right, you may find a mobile home.
You may.
That's under 13,
yeah.
But,
yes.
But the reality, I think, in the context, because there's vacant and then there's underutilized.
Right.
Where it can turn over, and especially
yes.
in commercial and industrial.
Yes.
You know, we know that the national model is commercial land turns over on a 20-year basis and gets knocked down or totally remodeled and everybody's out and new tenants are in.
Right.
And at $67,000.
Well, I think the way to look at this is, where we have an issue with this is, if you take Shorties, for example, you know where Shorties is on 99? What is happening is that Shorties may have a very small, maybe a mobile home office, and then have an open area where they display their plants and, you know, supplies. What the assessors is doing is, when they look at that property, they put in the value of that property on the building, regardless of the fact that someone can come in tomorrow and tear that up and rebuild it. If where Shorties is now, and it's not where they used to be. If you look at the development that occurred south of Shorties, where the Walgreens went in and all that, I worked on that. That was where Shorties was before. Mm-hmm. They moved to a much smaller size. So when we looked at that, where Shorties used to be, where Walgreens and other things have developed, we will say, oh, on a 67, if they put all the values and left the parking lot, for example, with no value added to it, you have to say that, you know, what was where Shorty's real office was, it's probably not worth up to 67,000. I don't know that. But that's how this model looks at those type of areas. You may find some other places where the value may be more than 67,000. But it depends, because we are relying on the assessor's database. It depends on where they put that value on. That's really what is happening. And there may be some areas too, if you look at some like Walmart as an example, or where they have their building, if they put the value of the building on Walmart and leave the parking space, oh, 67,000 is pretty small. But there are vacant parks within their parking lot or area that yet needs to be developed that we are not capturing, that other development will occur. So this is an area that we acknowledge that we have to do a better work in reviewing and rely on the best information or from the assessors to be able to say what would this value be in the future going forward. Assessors is also struggling with the way they assess underutilized and some of these facilities where you have a huge parking lot with some pads on it sitting to be developed. You know, you look at where Fred Meyer was before Fred Meyer on 34th. Well, the only thing that first went in there was Fred Meyer. But you look at this, a bank, this other thing in their facilities, which also add to job and commercial retail. If we said all that is used up, it is not appropriate way to measure that. So those are the type of things we're trying to capture because there is capacity out there that we may be missing.
So
but this value.
One thing for me, Oliver.
Yes, sir.
If the building is empty and not being used, but it's valued at more than $67,000, does it call itself vacant or does?
Well,
we'll
say it's underutilized.
How do you know that it's vacant?
It's not vacant. We might even go into build. It's not vacant. You have to get to the shoddy example that I used to be able to say it is vacant. We might put it into the category of underutilized.
Okay. Maybe I didn't say this the way I wanted to. If it's truly vacant,
it will be vacant.
How do we know it's vacant if it values more than $67,000?
If the value, or it could be a house that is zoned commercial, don't know the shape of the house is in. Remember, there are two ways to look at what is vacant. Residential vacant, we are putting at 13,000.
Yeah.
Commercial and industrial, we say, about 67,500. There are some areas we've seen this where you have the same example where a contractor has a mobile home as his office, sitting in an area that is zoned for BP or ML or commercial. If the value of that mobile home that they're using as their office is less than 67,000, what would say is vacant?
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it right.
Yeah. I hope I'm answering your question. But that's the way we look at this model. There's other issues we look at. There's other issues we look at to be able to say, is it underutilized or is it vacant? But that's the values that the assessors, use that we are relying on. And we acknowledge that we need some more work to refine this and define it much better as we get more information. But the board agreed that we should continue to use this, and as we get more information, we'll refine it. I don't know whether we'll refine it in this process or in the next go around. The other change that they made quickly is on the market factor. You all know what that means. It is if you need 100 acres and you determine that that's how much you need, you have to, the assumption here is on residential. In 94, we added additional 25% of land. That would be for 100 acres, you add 25% of 100. You add that in addition to 100 acres you said you need for residential to account for some market fluctuation. People who are willing to sell or not willing to sell, or for properties that may tie up in court or whatever. But the reason for the market factor is really the function there. You look at it as a fudge factor or a cushion to account for those market fluctuation, or to make sure that the boundary is not set too tight to impact land values and land prices as well as housing prices. So these are the percentages that have been used over time. In 2000...
You call it a market factor, it's like a fudge factor.
It is a fudge factor, yeah.
It's fancy way of saying fudge factor.
Yeah.
On these last ones, the top two they confirmed, these last three, are those ones that the board hasn't decided for sure on?
They've decided at a work session. I want them to take... I want them to formally take public input on the 24th and then adopt them. June 24th. I would like to formally write a resolution that said that they've taken action on it.
On this slide,
yes.
And my for clarity on the VBLM, say that's the value of the improvements?
We could, but we could change that to.
And only because I just realized that today. I've been trying to figure out where on earth there's land that's valued at less than $13,000.
Exactly. It's just the improvements.
If we can do that.
Less than that, they're just going to pretend the improvement's not there. Basically.
Right. And I get that now. Just for clarity for the public, this is, I mean, there's been decent people at the work sessions that might be.
We'll look at that. You're absolutely correct, because it's really the improvement on the land. So we will do that. So the board made a change. They returned the 10% on residential. In 2007, it was zero for commercial and industrial. They asked us, with the decision they made on job, just to make sure that there is adequate supply of commercial and industrial. So they asked us to use a 10% for 10% market factor or push factor for commercial and industrial for the 2016. Okay? That's one of the only major change I think they made. The others are inconsequential, if you ask me. You're recognizing what is reality, 2.66 of persons per household. You're moving to a better way to measure jobs to housing in terms of ratio. The infrastructure, I think they may still agree with that this average is okay, recognizing that when you add, even though this is on residential, but when you add the 25% on commercial and industrial, you're over 50% for infrastructure alone, total. Okay, let me move quickly. Again, we have a work session with the board on the growth allocation. I'm hoping that my meeting with the cities next Friday, we will come to agreement on the growth allocation, and then we'll present that to the board on the 24th with the planning assumptions, principles and values. These two are really the board affirming what they've already directed us to use in a work session, formally taking public input and affirming what they've directed us to use. That's really my goal of taking it to a hearing. This is the measure. All of these are going to a hearing. They cannot take action according to our legal counsel at a work session. They can direct us to do something, but they have to take public input or testimony, whatever, before they make a final decision on that. We are going to be proposing at that same work session. It looks like I have a lot on the plate, but I do. I'm going to be asking the board to suspend and give you some break so you can focus on the what is coming to you in terms of the plan update. As soon as we get into phase two, you got to be really very occupied looking at what is it that we're doing. So I'm going to be asking the board to suspend the 2015 annual review and dockets, so that, you know, I don't know whether the board will agree, but the goal is, you know, we don't have the luxury to go to the end of the year. We are supposed to complete this by June 2015. So even if you start annual review, you're not going to finish that, you know. So what this will do, however, is that it will give us a break and free staff time to focus on the plan update. But it will also mean that annual reviews will not start until 2017. Just want to make that clear.
But if we're doing a comp plan change, we would be taking a lot of that into account already, right?
Yes, that's part of the reason. So I'm here before you today. We've gone through these items.
It would be a fee-free annual review, because anybody could come in and say this.
We're already receiving requests. Yeah. Now we are docketing it, so it's going to be free. To what extent we make those changes, I don't know yet. But depending on the directive from the board, we'll consider that. Doing an annual review that's site-specific when you're doing a plan, a comprehensive plan update, is very, very time-consuming. But June 19th, I have a work session with the board on growth allocation. and I will present to them what I'm calling issue paper four. The issue paper number four is really summarizing how we went about the growth allocation and the agreement we reached with the cities. You will also see issue paper four when I bring it to the board, the PC, on June 19th. That's the only thing that is on your work session before your hearing. Sorry. I apologize. Okay. Quickly, as I said, we are going to be moving into phase two with the growth allocation. The cities are going to be coming to the county with proposed land use and their vision and how the growth allocated to them is going to play out in terms of land use and so forth. With that information, we are going to be looking at, okay, what level of SEPA review do we have to do? And that will entail looking at both natural and built environment. You know this, I don't have to go through this. But what we are going to be looking at is what we are calling a supplemental environmental impact statement. We are going to be reviewing what I think we'll do, and Chris is going to help us flesh this out. We have a 2007 EIS that was done as part of the 07. We are going to look at the three scenarios that will come out of our process with the cities and determine what level of analysis we need to do. If it doesn't rise to the level of environmental impact statement, we will rely on the 2007 one that was done and take that out to the public with the three scenarios. Typically, our first alternative is do nothing, status quo. Second and third alternative are the changes you made to the existing. There may be changes, which I'm going to get to you quickly. The board have not made a decision, for example, on the surface mining. When they make a decision on what the map will look like, we may fold that in either alternative two or three, because it will no longer be status quo, just as an example. And whatever the cities, we talked about size-specific requests, if we do get those and make changes, it's not going to be the same with the status quo. It is a change which may fall into either two or alternative three. If any of the cities are proposing to expand the boundary for job or whatever, whether it's battleground, the center, it will fall into any of the two alternatives. So we will go out with three alternatives and alternative land use and begin dialogue with the public. What level of analysis do we have to do? Does it rise to the level, or does those three alternatives provide will lead the type of land use proposed lead to adverse environmental impact? That decision will have to be made with public input before we decide the level of SEPA we have to do. So that's where we are going to very soon. We have calendared some dates for open houses we're going to do for our scoping before we draft the what we're calling draft supplemental environmental impact statement. That will be released, and I think we have about 21 days comment, public comment. After that is we pass that comment period, we will take all the comment we received on the draft SEIS and then draft what will be the final SEIS and take that to hearing before you and the board, and we are done. All this we are hoping to get going by August. I want to be at least be at a hearing before the PC and the board. May 2015, we should be done. So that's really what we have going.
I have a question, Chris. If we put one of the three proposals together as no change, how rigid is the interpretation of no change? Does that mean it has to completely and utterly match existing, or is no change a generalized statement that says the boundaries don't grow, but we are able to reallocate resources within those boundaries?
Well, that's an interesting question. There are so many different parts of a comprehensive plan besides the boundaries of the urban growth area.
Absolutely, yeah, and they all change according to the allocations.
Right. I would say no change means no change.
Okay,
yes.
And I just wanted to be really clear. So what we're saying, one of the alternatives then is truly to take what's in existence,
yes,
and just to carry it forward and make that work.
Yes.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Which we would have to be able to say then actually passes muster as far as the higher job growth analysis. Otherwise, we have the conflict of the no change and a new job growth number.
And a lower population.
And a lower population, yes. We have significant analytical work we have to do to
okay.
be able to, yeah, that's coming. But
no,
that's where
the statute.
Yes.
Required to
right.
Change.
Well,
no change. I understand that,
yes.
But we have something in place now that we have publicly stated we want to move away from or modify.
Right.
Right.
You've got to analyze no change.
You have to still analyze no change.
Yeah.
But
what you're doing is you're analyzing it to compare the environmental
impact. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you're not saying this is what we're going to do. You're going to say if we continue in the direction we are now, this is what we expect to happen, as opposed to what would happen with alternatives one or two.
So another alternative could be the boundary stays the same, but we reallocate for job and population changes.
Sure.
Yes.
And then that's just another,
that's another
alternative.
That's
okay.
Another.
Okay.
That's what I mean, that even the map, when the board finally makes a decision on the surface mining map designation, remember your recommendation was to take some areas off that the mining have been depleted and to add some new areas in terms of expansion. I don't know what they're going to do, but the outcome of that to me is a change in your mapping, which we may have to analyze one way or the other, whether that rises to any significant impact on the environment, built or natural. So that's all I have to present. This is more of us trying to picture how this is going to flow. This goes from left to right, down, again, down, and we will be here with the hearing and with the final SCIS, whatever we're calling it. That's going to be the document you're going to be using in your hearing, and with that you make your recommendation to the board, and the board will be using the same final SCIS, if that's what is finally determined that we are doing, until they make their decision. And when challenged, that will be the document and the preferred alternative that is being challenged. So that summarizes my update to you. If you have questions, I'll take them. I started indicating that the board did not make any decision on the mining. I will also say that I don't know what decision that they're going to make, but I met with the county administrator today. My understanding is that he will be checking in with the commissioners and see when they will be able to schedule a hearing. It might be in July. So stay tuned. If that happens, we'll update you as to the final decision that they made. If there's any of them that they remanded back to you, we'll let you know. But they have your decisions, they have your recommendations, so we'll see what happens. We've always said that when an issue or a project goes to a hearings, anything can happen. So the board have your recommendations. We'll see whether they uphold it or make changes to them. It is they have the prerogative to do so.
I have to say, I was hearing very different things from them after the joint meeting that you had from what I was hearing before. I really think that they did not understand the breadth and depth of and detail of your analysis until that meeting. And, you know, maybe they could have and should have, but they didn't. And I think they now do. So that did something good, I think.
So, are you closing out the meeting?
We are done. Yeah.
Okay.
That's it. We are adjourned.